Sounds True presents Take 2 of After the Ecstasy, The Laundry with Jack Kornfield.
Nachiketa and the Lord of Death. One ancient teaching story from India tells of a young man, Nachiketa, and the way he came to stand face to face with death. After the death of several friends, Nachiketa felt the brevity of life. He saw the shallowness that comes from worldly pursuits when these activities are divorced from spiritual understanding. The son of a rich merchant, he knew that the heart's happiness did not come from the amount of property we own. This explains his reaction when his father was encouraged by the Brahmin priests of the community to make a grand donation to the temple in order to ensure himself a good rebirth in the afterlife. Nachiketa was appalled by the idea that virtue and merit could be purchased in a proud public display in the town center while everyone in the town looked on. The day arrived. "I give my cattle, my gold, all of value to the priests of the temple," the father declared. "All you value, ha!" demanded Nachiketa. "What about me, your son?" Publicly shamed and offended by these words, Nachiketa's father responded angrily, "I give you as well. I give you to death." And Nachiketa's eyes blazed and he replied, "And I accept." And then he left. Nachiketa went to a remote spot in the deepest forest and sat, waiting for death to show himself. For 3 days and 3 nights, he sat there intent and motionless, determined to track down the white ox and look into its eyes, determined to face death in his spiritual quest. Sitting through hunger, pain, and exhaustion, Nachiketa finally came to the land of Yama, the king of death, also known as the keeper of accounts. There, he was greeted by death's 3 assistants, pestilence, famine, and war, who explained that Lord Yama was away. "He's out collecting rent." "That's fine," said Nachiketa. "I will wait." When death returned 3 days later, his assistants told him of this most unusual young man who had come seeking him. Humans who hear of the Lord of Death usually run the other way, but this young man had been waiting steadily for 3 days. Lord Yama went to Nachiketa. They greeted one another, and then the Lord of Death apologized for keeping him waiting. "Welcome to my kingdom. I see you are a man intent on his journey. Alas, I've kept you waiting. I will make up for the 3 days you waited by offering you a boon. You may choose 3 blessings for your journey." During the time of journeying and waiting, Nachiketa had entered the liminal space between worlds where truth is revealed. And now 3 blessings were offered by the Lord of Death. In this luminous state of mind, he recognized what he most needed to go on. The first boon Nachiketa requested was forgiveness for himself and all he had touched. "Let my father look upon me with the same joy as the day I was born." Nachiketa knew that only by releasing his past, by reconciling with all that was incomplete in his heart, could he continue his journey. In asking forgiveness for himself, Nachiketa was also forgiving his father, for forgiveness must always travel in both directions. This is not a simple matter of will, nor is forgiveness always easy. To forgive may require us to open to a long process of outrage, sorrow, and grief. Forgiveness does not mean we condone the injustices of the past. We may vow, "Never again will I allow this to happen." In the end, rather, forgiveness is simply a letting go of past pain and hatred. Through its softening kindness, we free ourselves from blind repetition, from carrying the pain of the past into the future. To forgive means we do not put another person out of our heart. As Nachiketa knew, He could not put his father out of his heart if he was to continue on his path with his full being. Reunion with life is the blessing granted by forgiveness, and the boon of forgiveness left Nachiketa's heart open and clear. Lord Yama looked at him directly and noted, "Your first boon was a wise one, Nachiketa. Now what will be your second? Speak." After a moment's silent reflection, Nachiketa spoke, "I ask the blessing of inner fire." Nachiketa knew that to succeed on his spiritual journey, he would need both ardor and courage to follow the path with his whole being. So Nachiketa asked for the strength to give himself fully to his quest. Inner fires, wholehearted energy, spiritual passion, shakti, a full aliveness of being. This necessary fire or fullness in initiation is not to be confused with ambition, striving, or grasping after a goal. It is not an effort to improve ourselves or to attain something special. In the boon of aliveness, Nachiketa did not ask to get to the end of an imagined journey, but to be fully where he was. It takes the energy of our entire presence to meet and tame the sacred ox. And again, Lord Yama honored Nachiketa's wisdom, blessing him with inner strength. Free from the restrictions of old conflict and filled now with the limitless energy of perseverance, Nachiketa had found much of what is necessary to pass through initiation. Finally, the Lord of Death asked Nachiketa to name his last boon. After reflecting, Nachiketa looked at Death and said, "I ask for that which is immortal." With some surprise, Death reminded this audacious young man that he had come to the last boon and that he could choose anything. Lord Yama then conjured up visions of what Nachiketa might choose instead, a harem of beautiful maidens to travel on his journey with him, a royal golden war chariot with the world's fastest steeds, a palace where Nachiketa would be king. Nachiketa viewed all of these and more. "Why not choose among these?" Death urged again. But Nachiketa was a determined youth not easily led astray, for once we have seen the white ox, we know a flea circus for what it is. And so he questioned the visions, asking Lord Yama, "Will not all of these things that you have shown me return soon enough to your own kingdom?" The Lord of Death smiled at Nachiketa's understanding and answered, "Yes, it is true." Then Nachiketa repeated, "I ask to know that which is immortal." At this, Lord Yama said, "I will grant your third boon," and he handed Nachiketa a simple and yet extraordinary gift, a mirror. "If you wish to find the secret of immortality, Nachiketa, I cannot help you more than this. You yourself must look directly into yourself. Then you must repeatedly ask yourself the greatest of all human questions, who am I? Look beyond your body and thoughts, Nachiketa. In this way, you will find what you seek." Whether it is enacted in initiation or in meditation, we too must face Lord Yama. We must ask who it is that is born and dies. As Nachiketa gazed into the sacred mirror, he entered into the profound spiritual questioning that leads to the deathless. When everything he held was released and was stripped away, a pure and timeless heart arose, and Nachiketa was free. The lessons of Nachiketa. First, disenchantment. Each of the steps of Nachiketa's initiation are reflected in the journey of modern seekers. The same eternal themes arise: the need to face death, the requirement of forgiveness, the finding of energy and courage, and the seeking of truth. These tasks resonate in the heart of all who follow a path of awakening. Like so many we have met in this book, Nachiketa's first call to initiation was a fierce disenchantment, compelling turn away from the superficial values of this world. Our disenchantment with our own parents, our community, even religion, may actually support our journey. Joseph Campbell used to lament that organized religion all too often offers an inoculation against the mystical, empty rituals that undermine the spiritual impulse with a second-hand version. There are many ways in which we each have lost our hearts to false gods. It may take a shock or a blow, like the death of Nachiketa's friends, or the hypocrisy of the priests who promised his father salvation for money, to return us to our heart. The value of our harshest difficulties is how honestly they cause us to question, how they intensify our courage and bring alive our deepest inner purpose, how they reawaken our soul's task on earth. The painful breaking apart of our world is often the precious opportunity our heart has needed to learn to be true to itself. My own meditation master used to ask us about our spiritual life. "Hey, which have been the most valuable lessons, the comfortable times or your difficulties?" When disenchantment arises, the very suffering and struggle it causes brings us the courage to question in the face of all odds. Like Nachiketa, we are required to abandon certainty and comfort and to put our trust in the questioning itself. There comes a longing to tell the truth. Kabir, the Indian mystic, understood this seeking. "It is the intensity of the longing that does all the work," he said. Steadily facing the unknown. In many initiation stories, the search for what is beyond death is described as the heroes crossing the great water, climbing the impossible mountain, confronting dragons, or facing the armies of Mara, who personifies the forces of evil. In each of these images, we risk the life we have known to discover something new. Perhaps they are so daunting because the unknown territory of initiation will open before us only to the extent that we turn our whole being courageously toward it. In willingly facing the unknown, we offer trust in a greater purpose to life, and then we must venture wherever the road leads us, in spite of the dark, in spite of the quivering of our heart. To steadily face the unknown demands the help of the practice or ritual to which we have entrusted ourselves. For Nachiketa, help came through unwavering meditation, motionless sitting for 3 days and 3 nights. For others, it is unceasing prayer in the midst of crisis, or a traditional ritual of initiation led by elders. The intensity of the longing and the steadiness of turning toward the unknown will bring us to Lord Yama's kingdom. The encounter with death can take many forms. Like the remote forest Nachiketa entered, the monasteries of Thailand, where I trained as a Buddhist monk, were purposefully situated in areas known for wild animals, dark caves, and ghosts. The training included sitting alone all night or meditating in forest charnel grounds, staying with the corpses that were being cremated until the fire went out at dawn. In the natural course of our everyday lives, illnesses or childbirth can bring us face to face with death, changing the life that follows. Like Nachiketa's ordeal, my wife's labor for our daughter Caroline also took 3 days and 3 nights. We breathed together, held hands, waited. She became progressively more exhausted and surrendered hour after hour until the final intense stages of labor carried her into the world of motherhood. In initiation, we give birth to ourselves. An English-born Tibetan nun who spent 12 years on retreat in caves in the Himalayas tells of having to rely on her spiritual practice to sustain her life when a huge avalanche covered her cave and her valley, killing many. After digging an air hole, she meditated through a long winter darkness of many days and nights. Each initiation offers a test in which we are asked to abandon the old and open to a greater vision. Sometimes an initiation occurs in private, and sometimes it asks us to enter a collective ritual of transformation, to embrace a public act of courage. During the 1970s pro-democracy movement in Thailand, the students and military police waged days of pitched battle in the streets of Bangkok, leaving hundreds of students dead or wounded. One morning, after a bloody fight the day before, a Bangkok meditation master called together his monks and nuns and told them it was time to test their training. Then he led nearly 100 robed figures with their alms bowls, single file, down to the conflict. They walked in the no man's land between the barricades. Guns were lowered. Tensions eased as they stood there, robed figures for peace, reminding all sides present of another possibility. That morning, the gradual process of reconciliation truly began. Forgiveness and Reconciliation. Nachiketa's initiation also required the blessing of reconciliation and forgiveness. As long as he was enacting his journey as a fight with his father, he was inwardly diverted from his true task, to face his own fear and awaken his own heart. Forgiveness is both a preparation and an end in spiritual life, a theme we return to many times. To forgive, we must face the pain and sorrow of our betrayal and disappointment, and discover the movement of the heart that opens to forgive in spite of it all. Like Nachiketa, each of us will find our hearts closed or feel ourselves hostage to the past at times during our journey. Our process of forgiveness may include speaking out and seeking justice, but in the end, it also requires a compassionate letting go, for our own sake as much as for others. It is like the meeting of two former prisoners of war. When one asked, "Have you forgiven your captors?" the other replied, "No, never." The first ex-prisoner looked with kindness at his friend and said, "Well, then they still have you in prison, don't they?" The initiation of mature spiritual teachers has always required forgiveness for others, for themselves, for life itself. Without the wise heart of forgiveness, we carry the burdens of the past our whole life. One nurse, a senior practitioner who works in labor and delivery, tells this story. Even though they're painful, most labors go well, and there's the tremendous joy once the parents can hold the baby. But I noticed that when there's a tragedy and a baby is stillborn or dies, the other nurses call me. I think it's because of what I've been through. When I was 8 years old, I was left in charge of my younger sister and my 3-month-old baby brother for the day. That day, he died a crib death. For years, I felt responsible and had incredible pain about it. My mother never told me it was my fault, but she never told me it wasn't. And she never allowed any grief. I was a big girl, and big girls don't cry. When I went to nursing school, I still carried that guilt. I worked at night in a cancer center with people on respirators. Sometimes they would beg me to let them die. What was outside reflected what was inside me. It was tremendously hard, and then I went to my first meditation retreat. In the silence, it all came up. So many scenes, my brother's death, the hospitals, waves of grief and sorrow from the past, and I realized that in all these years, I had never forgiven my mother or myself. For days in silence, I just sat with all the pain, as if I was in labor, and I wept. And then came that forgiveness I'd been looking for all my life. I felt a grace. My heart opened to loving myself and forgiving my mother, letting go of all that got in the way of being alive and loving. I've been meditating now for almost 20 years, and somehow I've found the ability to be with anguish and pain without having to control it or change it, so that now the doctors and nurses call me in. Sometimes I sit with the parents, and we just hold hands and cry together in their vulnerability, holding a damaged fetus and facing the terrible decisions they have to make. In the end, it's only forgiveness that makes this life workable. While self-forgiveness is essential, the wounds that others have caused us are also a necessary gate for our healing. A teacher in a Hindu ashram describes a period during which he was confronted with memories of his stepfather's harshness and mistrust. He'd raised me since I was 2, and for years I was either fighting him or trying to win his approval. Then one day, after a month-long yoga retreat, I was walking out in the open fields past the ashram, and it hit me that my stepfather didn't have long to live. And I realized that for all these years he had tried to love me, but because of his own harsh father, he could never let his feelings show. He was too afraid. In his own awkward way, he had raised me as his boy, and in my own awkward way, I forgave him. I went back to visit him. So much in my life lightened up after that. Thank God for forgiveness. Sometimes it's not so much that we forgive harmful actions as that we learn to acknowledge and respect the hard struggle of life itself. A story of the Second World War shows how a forgiving and tender heart can allow us to enter the world anew. Many Japanese soldiers were stationed on islands throughout the Pacific during World War II. As the Japanese pulled back, these islands were so quickly abandoned that when the war ended, there were still hundreds of loyal soldiers on duty who had no knowledge of their defeat. Over a few years, most of these men were found and brought back in by local people. But, as is common knowledge, a small number, hidden in caves and forests, continued to maintain their positions. They believed themselves to be good soldiers, trying to remain faithful to their country and defend the Japanese nation as best as they could in the face of grave hardships. One might wonder how these men were treated when they were finally found after 10 or 15 years. They were not considered misguided or fools. Instead, whenever one of these soldiers was located, the first contact was always made very carefully. Someone who'd been a high-ranking Japanese officer during the war would take his old uniform and samurai sword out of the closet, take an old military boat to the area where the lost soldier had been sighted. The officer would walk through the jungle, calling out for the soldier until he was found. When they met, the officer, with tears in his eyes, would thank the soldier for his loyalty and courage in continuing to defend his country for so many years. Then he would ask him about his experiences and welcome him back. And only after some time would the soldier gently be told that the war was over and his country was at peace again, so he would not have to fight any more. When he reached home, he would be given an honorable welcome, celebrating his arduous struggle and his return to and reunion with his people. We've judged ourselves and others for so long, carrying on our battle with the past, with life itself. In forgiveness, we bow to it all with mercy and respect. It is the way we begin to tame the white ox, by befriending it. With forgiveness, our hearts become clear and whole for a time. The courage of our forgiveness frees us to enter the next step in our initiation. Inner fire. Nachiketa's second request was for inner fire, the ardor and courage needed to persevere with his journey even in the face of death. This passion and willingness to open, to discover, to learn is one of the central qualities of all who progress in spiritual life. The quality of inner fire can transform any obstacle and difficulty into the very process of awakening and illumination. We each treasure the moments when we are fully alive. With spiritual passion, we can awaken no matter where we are. So when one student complained to my teacher Ajahn Chah that in his very busy life he did not have time to meditate, Ajahn Chah laughed and said, "Do you have time to breathe? If you are determined, you must simply pay attention. This is our practice, wherever we are, whatever is happening, to breathe, to be fully present, to see what is true." One Buddhist teacher recalls her early years in Zen. She describes how deeply she was inspired by the master, by the wholeness of his presence, his compassion, and spontaneity. She wanted to be alive like that. "I sat in the Zendo, but I really had no idea of what to do. The one instruction I can remember is, die on the pillow. I would sit there with considerable enthusiasm thinking, yes, I want to do this, but I hadn't a clue as to how to proceed. Then, as I attended other retreats, I gradually learned that the way to do that was to give myself more and more fully to the practice itself. I found an organic expansion of my capacity to sit longer and sleep less, until finally, at my first 3-month Vipassana retreat, I found myself on fire with energy for practice and only needing 3 hours sleep. As I gave myself to it, my inner strength grew." Sometimes this inner fire is thrust upon us. One of my teachers, Deepa Ma Barua of Calcutta, was a great yogi. After the death of her husband and 2 of her children, she felt compelled to begin meditation training. When she started, she became quite ill in those first days at the temple, but nothing would deter her. Being too weak to walk, she crawled up the steps of the temple and sat there, so determined was she to face her fears and come to freedom. Even those in prison can find a way to this freedom. Aware of the painful fact that we are now spending more funds on our prison system than on educating our children, many spiritual communities have begun providing teachings to the millions under lock and key. These teachings are offered under the principle that all human beings need to find inner freedom and salvation, and that no one is beyond redemption. Fleet Mall, a prisoner following the Tibetan teachings of Thrangu Rinpoche, writes, "The noise and lack of privacy are the greatest obstacle to doing formal meditation practice in prison. From 7 a.m. to 11 p.m., the prison's overcrowded living areas are in an almost constant uproar. To practice during these hours, I used to clean out one of the sanitation closets where the mops, brooms, and trash barrels are kept. I would set everything outside so that I wouldn't be disturbed, take a chair, and sit for an hour or two. People thought I was a little strange sitting in the trash closet, but they got used to my being there. When I finally got a single cell after years of hellish overcrowding, I began Tibetan practice of 100,000 full-length prostrations and recitations. Now the guards come by to count heads at 5 a.m., so they see me doing full prostrations on the floor beside my bed." At some point, we must surrender our fears and hopes, dying to the way it was supposed to be, and opening anew to the mystery. Nachiketa did not ask to get to the end of an imagined journey, but to be fully where he was. Even a prison, even a palace, can be the site of awakening. Sometimes the surrender of initiation comes in joy and ecstasy. I visited a temple along the sacred Ganges River in Benares just as the pilgrims were completing a week-long devotional chant to the Divine Mother. For 7 days and nights, they chanted without stop. When exhausted, they would drop to sleep on the floor for a few hours and then start again. Without ceasing, without food, they chanted the name of God. Over and over, circling the altar, a crowd of devotees would chant the holy name to the sound of Indian harps and tambourines. One woman told me later how on the first days the pain and hunger, family concerns and worries would inwardly interrupt her chanting. But as she threw herself again and again into the holy name of God, gradually everything of herself dropped away, and she circled effortlessly, the spirit of the divine filling her with ecstasy as she swayed around the candlelight. This is one of the tasks of initiation. To the extent that we give ourselves wholeheartedly to the work of the Spirit, our life becomes simple and whole. Undying Blessings. Nachiketa's last request was for knowledge of that which is immortal, undying. Lord Yama responded, "To find that which is timeless, you must look into the heart of life itself." And then he handed Nachiketa a mirror. The mystery of identity, who am I, is one of humankind's central spiritual questions. Are we this body of flesh and blood? Is consciousness merely a product of our nervous system, our thoughts, our feelings? Are we our genetic heritage and ancestors' patterns? Or is our essential nature more fundamentally spiritual? Are we a creation of consciousness itself, a spark of the divine, a reflection of the universal mind? This is the inquiry of mystics and sages. In the forest monasteries where I practiced, a newcomer is ushered into a sacred grove to be offered ordination. Then, the elder instructs each new monk in the first and most important meditation practice. An investigation of the mystery of birth and death. You are directed to meditate on the question, who am I? First, you must examine your physical body to see that it is made up of earth, air, fire, and water, and how these form into the disparate parts of skin, hair, nails, teeth, fluid, blood, heart, liver, lungs, kidneys. In this bag of skin and bones, who are you? You are asked to investigate the question of identity, to release all that is impermanent in body and mind, and to discover a timeless awareness beyond birth and death. This question of identity is posed in many forms. During one annual 3-month insight meditation retreat, an old Korean Zen master from Nine Mountains Monastery came to speak. He told the students that whatever practice they were doing for 3 months was a waste of time. The only practice that is worthwhile, and he banged on his Zen staff and pointed to himself, is to ask, "What is this? What is this?" he shouted. The Indian sage Ramana Maharshi uses this self-inquiry almost exclusively to awaken his students. When people came to see him with troubles and questions, he would look at them with what is called the glance of mercy, a profound compassion for all the ways they were lost, and then he would direct them into the meditation of self-inquiry. Ask yourself, who am I? Who was born into this body? Solve this question, and all troubles will be solved. To ask this question is to look into Nachiketa's mirror. As each experience arises, it is questioned, is this who I really am? Is this the timeless? One experience arises after another, thoughts about oneself, images and plans, loves and fears, feelings toward or against something, changing sensations of sound and sights of the physical world. And each is seen for what it is, transient, limited, not able to last. In turn, each is released as not this, not that, until finally our entire sense of self is abandoned and we rest in a deep and unutterable silence. A Jewish mystic, the Mezritcher rabbi, taught the same truth, that we cannot change from our limited reality into another unless we first turn into nothing, the true state, that which is before and after all things. As we awaken, we discover that we're not limited by who we think we are. All the stories we tell ourselves, the judgments, the problems, the whole identity of the small sense of self, this body of fear, can be released in a moment, and a timeless sense of grace and liberation can open for us. As with facing death, the release of our old identity comes at a price. The price is paid in the letting go of all we hold and take ourselves to be, a stripping away until only the eternal remains. Through opening, initiation, difficulty, and grace, we come to know another reality. One American Lama I interviewed describes his initiation in this way. My greatest lesson came during the 3-year retreat. The whole 3 years and 3 months were filled with nonstop meditations and prayer and demanding practices both day and night. But then, halfway through the last year of the retreat, I received notice that my younger brother had died. It was either an accident or suicide. I got the telegram and my whole being went into shock. I was so open. It had thrown my whole family into chaos, grief, and despair. They wanted me at home to help them. I had to decide whether to leave the retreat and not finish it, because if you come out, you cannot return, or whether to stay. It was like standing at the edge of a huge cliff. I asked my revered Tibetan master. He told me that in the course of a 3-year retreat, many people would be born and many die, and that many obstacles would happen. He said I could do what I wanted, but he reminded me that I had vowed to stay in retreat for 3 years. It was a very absolute, unwavering answer. So I sat, and overwhelming waves of helplessness and grief, guilt and fear washed over me. Every part of my conditioning, every identity I had held from my life until then, was screaming to go back home. I felt the conflict in every cell of my body. I was being torn apart. But I had also committed myself to practice in a realm of absolute truth, to find universal compassion for every single being. And to fulfill that, I realized I would have to let go of my personal attachment. Then I knew somehow that I had to stay. It was like jumping off a cliff in absolute darkness. It was incredibly difficult. Yet through the practice and my teacher's spirit, I was connected to the absolute freedom of my true nature, no matter what happens. Now I simply know it's true. When I came out half a year later and saw my family, by then they were supportive and happy. They were happy I'd finished and that I could be with them in an entirely new way. I feel now that all I went through in that retreat and in the depth of my own conscious struggles was ultimately helpful to them. There's a direct parallel in the Christian tradition. To awaken to the great heart of Jesus, we must, quote, be willing to tread for a long time as a blind man in darkness. So wrote St. John of the Cross. The contemplative masterpiece, The Cloud of Unknowing, insists that the true contemplative must die to themselves and lose the radical, self-centered awareness of our being, for it is our own self that stands in the way of God. One Sufi master describes how frightening this loss of identity was to him as his spiritual life opened. As I looked at all I held to be me, the separate individual, it began to unravel. At first there was an openness, an emptiness, but with it came a rush of fear, a struggling to exist, some kind of terror. I felt that I was letting go of everything. My whole sense of self had given way. One day, during this, I was sitting in a window seat on an airplane, and it felt like I was falling out of the window, and the terror came in big waves, irrational and very strong. I felt just like an animal falling in space. Only later, when I learned to let go into it, to let myself fall, did it open up into a cloudless sky where I disappeared. For this Sufi teacher, initiation felt like he was dying. One Hindu teacher with whom I spoke had a more literal experience of near death. After years of yoga and meditation, mostly in the West, he returned at 43 to spend a year in India. After months in the ashram, I went on pilgrimage to Benares, Allahabad, and Rishikesh, and then I got quite ill. Found myself in a horrible, dirty hospital with very little money and no friends around, so weak I had difficulty even talking. I felt sure I would die there all alone, and in many days of high fever, I did come quite close to death. I lay there shaking and afraid, and after some confused days, it dawned on me that this is what my years of training were for. I closed my eyes and could feel the end of my life was just a small breath away. I could feel the whole world of birth and death circling around me. It was in my whole body, the pain, the seeking for pleasure. And as I faced the enormity of the fear, it was as if I died a little. Then there arose a pure knowing. This is not who you are. I knew that what the yogis had taught me was true, and my resistance fell away. There is that which is deathless, and it is found only when we face death. Afterward, I returned a healed and humbled man. I felt like I died a little is a similar phrase used by Ijukerjuk, a renowned Eskimo shaman, to describe his initiation during a 30-day winter fast in a tiny snow hut. By virtue of this journey, Ijukerjuk became a great wise man and healer. If we are to be free, like Nachiketa, we too must ask our sacred questions and follow them even to Lord Yama and the land of death. It is there that we find undying blessings. There is one more event in the story of Nachiketa. At its conclusion, we see the young man bowing to Lord Yama a final time, now totally at peace. And then, as if by magic, the landscape of the kingdom of death changes to the spring rice fields of his native India. In this, a last secret is revealed to him. Death and birth are not separate. Renewal comes by dying. When we have faced death and aloneness, we are unafraid to live, and life flowers under our feet. Everywhere we go becomes holy ground. Nachiketa knew this now in his own heart and walked off toward his home to embrace his father and start a new life. If his story were to be painted by a student of Zen, we might see walking by his side the gentle figure of a white ox tamed. Part 2, The Gates of Awakening. Every spiritual tradition has stories of those who have awakened from their usual dreamlike state to a sacred way of being. Through initiation, purification or prayer, or by a great, spacious surrender to the dance of life, they come to know that which is ever-present and holy. The founder of Japanese Zen, Dogen, explained, "The human mind has absolute freedom as its true nature. There are thousands upon thousands of students who have practiced meditation and obtained this realization. Do not doubt the possibilities because of the simplicity of the method. If you can't find the truth where you are, where else do you expect to find it?" There is a part of each of us that knows eternity as surely as we know our own name. It may be forgotten or covered over, but it is there. Like Nachiketa, we have only to ask for the truth, and we will learn that it is found in the mirror. My teacher Ajahn Chah called this center of wisdom within us the one who knows. The spiritual practitioners interviewed for this book discovered this center in themselves. But the one who knows is not found in practitioners alone. One famous study of American spiritual life found that the majority of those interviewed had had a mystical experience at some time in their life. However, the researchers also discovered that most of those people would not want it to happen again. Why is this? What we have no words for, we cannot understand. It does not fit into our view of what is real. And if we stumble upon it, as the study shows, we may be taken by surprise and frightened. On the unknown places of their maps, the ancient cartographers wrote, "Here there be dragons." Yet as surely as we inhabit the mystery of birth and death, as surely as the night is full of stars, as surely as we know the necessity of love, we contain the possibility of awakening. Even today, in many parts of the world, many people are recognized as enlightened or illuminated with holiness, or as sages and are widely revered. The sage in us, too, can be awakened. The one who knows can be found in our lives. There are numerous entry points to the eternal wisdom of the heart. They can be called the gates of awakening. Each gate is a doorway to ourselves, a doorway to the truth within us. Here are four of the most powerful, each described by those who have passed between their open hinges. You will recognize these passages in your own life.